Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk about the discrimination older workers are facing in the workplace and what employers might be able to do about it.
But first, we look at a new effort to reverse a longstanding policy on who can donate blood and who can't.
More than 80 lawmakers, including Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, are calling on the Obama administration to reverse a policy that prevents gay men from giving blood in the United States.
The policy's been in place since the early 80s. And our next guest says it's outdated and needs to be changed.
Jason Cianciato is Director of Public Policy at the Gay Men's Health Crisis, or GMHC. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, give us some background here. Why was this ban implemented about 30 years ago?
It was implemented in 1983, and we have to remember that back then there was very little known about HIV. In fact, HIV hadn't even been given its name yet. And so the FDA rightfully stepped in and put in place a policy based on the technology available and our knowledge at the time to help ensure that HIV was not being spread through the transfusion of donated blood. In particular, there was a very large population of people with hemophilia who were largely affected, including Ryan White, for whom the Ryan White Care Act was named after. But since then, we've had large advances in technology that enable us to test and find HIV in blood within as little as 7 to 10 days post-exposure. And so we should have a policy that reflects current technology, not the technology of 20 years ago.
Well, under current policy, when I go in to donate blood, I answer a lot of questions, and one of them is, have you had sexual contact with another man since 1977, right?
That's correct.
And then if you answer in the affirmative, they don't want your blood.
That's correct. You are banned for life. And our argument is that not only is that policy discriminatory because it excludes people based on what their particular identity might be, but it also actually doesn't support putting out the safest blood supply available. You know, GMHC is an HIV prevention organization, and our first and primary goal is reducing the spread of infection. So what we want to see happen is for the FDA to institute rules and policies that ask people questions that assess their risk, not necessarily just providing a blanket ban for their identity. So, for example, I've been married for 8 years and in a monogamous relationship for 10. My husband and I are HIV negative, yet I would be banned from donating blood for life. But a heterosexual person could go in and say that he had sex with someone he knew is HIV positive, and he would only be banned for 12 months.
So what would a new system look like? What would it look like if we were to change these things?
We would like a system that is based on what's happening, for example, in countries like Italy and Spain, that have changed policies away from blanket bans to risk-based. So in other words, the questionnaire would be revised, and someone would come in and be asked a series of questions that would help the screener be able to categorize them by a category of risk. We're not calling on the end to all deferral policies. For example, it's entirely plausible that someone might be asked to not donate blood for 12 months, depending on where they traveled or depending on their behavior. And it's also entirely possible that some people might be banned for life based on what they've said. But what we're asking for is for this lifetime blanket policy on all gay and bisexual men to be lifted so that people can be screened based on their risk level.
This seems like it was, as you said, it was justified when it came out. There's still been, is it still erring on the side of caution, which we kind of want in our blood supply, or is this being too cautious, the current policy?
We believe that a transfer or a shift to a risk-based policy would achieve everyone's goals of making sure that the blood supply is as safe as possible and that there's enough available, particularly in times of blood shortage that happened during the summer. And in screening out people regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity who are higher risk and enabling a large pool of people who are low to no risk to be able to contribute, to be able to give life to people.
What's been the response from groups like Red Cross or other medical organizations?
So the American Red Cross has supported this shift in policy. Recently, the American Medical Association came out, this was just in June of 2013, with a statement saying that the lifetime ban on gay and bisexual men donating blood was not only discriminatory, but also was not based in science. So we have the support of these major medical and health associations, and we just need the FDA to catch up.
And why haven't or why hasn't the FDA changed this policy, do you think?
Well, they are engaged right now in a very deliberative process where they are waiting for the results of some research studies to come out. But as was stated in the letter that came out of Senator Baldwin's office and signed by 84 members of Congress, the FDA has not updated the public or Congress on the status of these studies, when they can expect the information to be out. And so I'm very grateful that Senator Baldwin and these 84 leaders in Congress are going directly to Secretary Sebelius and the FDA and saying, you know, you need to update us on what's going on, and we need to make sure that this process is moving forward as planned.
With that letter from Senator Baldwin and her colleagues, do you think the Obama administration is going to listen? Do you think this is going to change?
I'm hopeful that it will. The Obama administration has been the most aggressive in history of producing legislation and policy that ends longtime discrimination on people, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. And so they have also been very focused on proper process. So, for example, even though President Obama could have overturned Don't Ask, Don't Tell with an executive order, he believed that it was right for that to come out of Congress, which it eventually did. And so I think that while supportive, the White House is going to sit back and let Congress and the FDA move through on the process that it's supposed to do. And if he feels that it's being held up unreasonably so, I'm confident that he would be supportive of pushing the FDA to move forward.
You mentioned the issue of discrimination. Do you think that this blood supply policy puts a stigma on gay men just by outright banning them for life?
It absolutely does, and I'm glad you raised that because it speaks to another mission-driven issue of why GMHC is taking the lead on this. We have seen time and time again that stigma, whether that's notions of racism, class, or sexual orientation and gender identity, all play a really large role in the transmission of HIV. They create the context in which people aren't equipped to or might, because of mental illness or out of fear, make decisions that aren't the best for their health or for the health of their partners. And so we need to make sure that the stigma that is leading people to believe that there's something inherently wrong with gay people's blood, or that, you know, we should be able to decide whether or not we get transfused gay people's blood, which has been on a lot of commentary and comments I've seen on articles that have come out about this, that our government is leading the way in ensuring that Americans realize that any person who is deemed low risk and wants to give of themselves to give life to people in need should be allowed to do so, regardless of who they are.
Jason, if this went into effect tomorrow, or the FDA says tomorrow, okay, we're changing the policy, how long would it take to see the difference at, say, the Red Cross?
That's a really great question. I'm honestly going to say I'm not really sure how long that would take. My hope is that the FDA, as it was previously regarding this research it's involved in, would be very forward and public with leaders, with health leaders, and accountable, so that we can make sure that these changes in policy are put out in a way that is responsible, but that also happen in a reasonable time that acknowledges the stigma and discrimination that's happening right now.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jason Cianciato. He's Director of Public Policy at GMHC.
Coming up next, as more older workers are staying in the workplace, discrimination against them is becoming more and more common. And oftentimes, these slights are subtle and unintentional. We'll talk about recognizing and dealing with age discrimination in the workplace right after the break. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
As more older workers remain on the job, age discrimination is becoming more and more common in workplaces across the country.
Sometimes it's an instance of intentionally hurtful words or actions. Sometimes it's subtle or even unintentional.
Joining us now is Jacqueline James, Director of Research at the Sloan Center for Aging and Work at Boston College. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So why do you think age discrimination seems to be relatively common these days?
Well, I think it's always been common. I think we're just talking about a little bit more as more people stay in the workforce and people are thinking more about it.
Mm-hmm. And are these, I guess, how is age discrimination manifesting itself now?
Well, there are a lot of perceptions about older workers that I would categorize as discriminatory. One is the idea that they might be ramping down at some particular age. A lot of people think after age 50, the employee is starting to think about retirement and when they're going to leave and looking forward to that. That's one instance. A lot of people think that older workers are less productive for that same reason. They're thinking ahead. They're thinking about getting out the door instead of deepening their engagement with the work. And so they're not as productive as other workers. And we find numerous studies find that just not to be true. Another perception about older workers that we think of as discriminatory is that they're not interested in training or development opportunities or never mind promotions. Some older workers really are. In fact, we have found in some of our research that when older workers are offered training and development opportunities, they are more engaged in their work. This is one of the things that makes older workers happy on the job and happy to be there. And finally, another one that we hear a lot about is that older workers are kind of behind the times in terms of technology. And I think that's the one that I don't have a lot of hard data on, but I would suggest is, you know, in a lot of cases true, but again, it's an unfair assumption because there are a lot of older people who have really gravitated toward technology and are just as savvy with it as some of the younger workers are.
Whose responsibility is it to combat these misconceptions? Is it management? Is it fellow colleagues?
Well, certainly, I think the first step in combating it is becoming aware of it, what it looks like and what it feels like, and learning more about how older workers are experiencing it in the workplace. We know that some 60 to 70% of workers do perceive that age discrimination is going on. So that's a lot of people, and it's important for an organization to get a grip on what that does to the morale in the workplace. And we know from the research that we've done that it is a negative factor in their engagement with their work.
Now, what I heard you describe were more maybe assumptions that you also construed as discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But how would you formally describe discrimination in the workplace? Are there is it a policy thing? Is it a form of treatment? How would you describe and define discrimination?
Well, actual discrimination is harmful behavior decisions, hiring and promotion decisions based on age.
And some people will make jokes about age, and where do you draw the line between good-natured ribbing and actual discrimination?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, because age discrimination is many things. It can be flagrant. I can decide that I'm just not going to hire anyone over a certain age in my organization, or I'm going to make my decision about a layoff strategy based on age. That's flagrant, but it can also be subtle. And the subtle ways are the teasing, the kinds of things that we all do that are considered harmless, making fun of age, those birthday cards and jokes that we make about our own aging. These are some of the more subtle ways. It also can be conscious, like I make an explicit decision about hiring or promotion on the basis of age, or unconscious. I'm not even aware of it. And we have talked in our work about little slights that people perceive in the workplace, like being referred to as a geezer or hearing someone behind you talk about how out of it you are. Or I heard one the other day where people were talking about older drivers as Q-tips because you can't see them over the the wheel of the car. And these are just little nicks that people perceive every day that we have seen as having a negative impact on older workers on the job. And the other thing about this that's difficult is that ageism is different than other kinds of isms that we study. Everybody ages. And it's interesting to note that older people themselves are ageist and guilty of these same kinds of slights and even sometimes overt discriminatory practices.
I'm a little surprised to hear you talk about people calling one another geezers and Q-tips, I guess, in the workplace, because that's, you know, it's it is partly discrimination, but also name-calling and unprofessional. I mean, how common is that?
Well, I don't know exactly how common it is, if, words like that, but I do know it's common that people perceive slights like that in the workplace, and we don't have a list of what they are. But that's one of the things that I think organizations need to be doing, is finding out about these kinds of slights that people are experiencing in the workplace.
Well, the AARP reports that one in five workers between ages 45 and 74 has been turned down for a job because of their age. First, I'm wondering how they collect, if you're able to answer this question, how they collect that data. How essentially, how do you prove age discrimination when it's not as if an employer is going to outright tell you that, that you're not hired because of your age?
I am not exactly familiar with that finding, but I would imagine it's based on a perception and not anything that you could prove, and that is one of the difficulties. In fact, even flagrant age discrimination is very hard to prove.
How would you try, I guess, how would you start picking away at that argument?
Which one?
that age discrimination exists.
I guess I wouldn't. I think it does exist, and I think the perception is reality in many respects. But again, it's very hard to prove because, as you say, people are very good at hiding it, even when they are behind closed doors acknowledging the reality of it.
What about potential employees? Does age discrimination make its way into the hiring process at all?
Well, of course, people think it does, and a lot of older people are blogging and writing and talking about how difficult it is to find a job beyond a certain age, and it's always some other excuse. No, but no employer is going to say, I didn't hire you because of your age. But a lot of people, the fact that it is so difficult for people over 55 to get back in the job market once they have been laid off or let go or their jobs eliminated, suggests that there is some age factor going on in decisions that are being made about hiring.
How would you recommend training employees to be more understanding of older workers or more accepting of them?
Well, first of all, I think it's also important to say that young people experience these slights and statements about how they're too young for things. So age perceptions of age discrimination kind of go both ways. So we argue that it's important to think of the workforce as multi-generational and consider the needs of all ages of workers and workers in all stages of life. Some 40-year-olds are just having their first child, and some 40-year-olds are grandparents. And this is not something that people think about a lot. But I would suggest that employers, as a first step, is to become aware that we do live and work in a multi-generational workforce. Probably for the first time in history, there are at least four generations working side by side in the workplace. And it's important to know what their needs are, and people's needs do change over time. And so it's also important to make age a part of any diversity discussion, any assumption about age, including assumptions about younger workers as well. In this way, we avoid pitting generations against each other or younger workers against older workers and vice versa.
What could each generation do to, I guess, in a way, stand up for themselves and prove their worth in the workplace?
Well, I think everybody has to be aware of perceptions of their particular age group and be able to refute those. So there's a lot of advice about, especially the idea that older workers are not up to speed with technology, that we get up to speed with respect to technology, and we're able to demonstrate that if we're in a hiring situation. And for younger workers, if they think they're entitled to a promotion that they've earned, that they have the experience for, then to learn methods for promoting their abilities and speaking to authority about what should be expected of them. And getting age out of the equation, both in the equation and out of the equation, in the equation in the sense that we understand it and know the perceptions that we all have around different ages and stages of life, and out of it by thinking of merit-based approaches to hiring and promotion decisions, and deliberately trying to get some of these negative ideas about age out of our heads.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jacqueline James is Director of Research at the Sloan Center for Aging and Work at Boston College.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the future of Milwaukee, whether it's on the verge of a renaissance or could be the next Detroit.
We'll talk to the author of You Are Now Less Dumb about ways we can think smarter and avoid common mental errors.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickard.
That music you're hearing is the theme song to the FX Network show The League. It's about a group of buddies competing in a fantasy football league. Just one example of how mainstream fantasy sports have become. Our next guest has been part of the evolution from a subculture to a major national pastime.
And we want to hear from you. Do you play fantasy sports? Is it more of a hobby or an obsession? What about it appeals to you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
Cynthia, I don't think of you as a big sports person. Have you done fantasy sports?
I did fantasy baseball.
You did baseball?
Yeah.
How long?
Only a couple of seasons.
Were you pretty into it? Hardcore?
I was not. And I actually remember trading a really powerful first baseman because I don't know why. And then, of course, the rest of the team laughed at me. But.
All right. Well, we'll laugh at you along with our guest, Matthew Berry. He is ESPN's senior fantasy analyst, author of the new book, Fantasy Life, The Outrageous, Uplifting, and Heartbreaking World of Fantasy Sports from the Guy Who's Lived It. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Now, good to be here.
First of all, a lot of people are into fantasy sports. Many people aren't or only sort of know about it. How would you describe it to somebody who's new to fantasy football, fantasy baseball?
Well, it's a game, and it's, frankly, it's a fun game. There's a reason why there are so many people that are into it. In fact, 13% of all Americans in 2012 played fantasy sports. To give you a comparison, just 8% of all Americans played golf. So almost twice as many people that play golf actually play fantasy sports. So I think probably more people play it than you might realize. But to describe it to someone who doesn't know it and doesn't really understand what it is, very simply, is it's a game where you draft real-life athletes, let's say NFL. So you would draft a real-life NFL player, say Aaron Rodgers, right? And if Aaron Rodgers throws 3 touchdowns for the Packers on Sunday, if he's your fantasy quarterback, he also throws 3 touchdowns for your team. Let's say you and I were playing each other, and I drafted Tom Brady as my quarterback. Aaron Rodgers throws 3 touchdown passes. Tom Brady throws 2 on Sunday for the Patriots, and we're playing each other. You're now beating me 3 touchdowns to 2. It's that simple. There's a little bit more in-depth in terms of scoring. You get points for yardage as well, but it's basically that. You're drafting a team of offensive players, quarterbacks, wide receivers, tight ends, running backs, kickers, that sort of thing, and how well they score statistically in their real-life NFL games is how well they do for their fantasy teams.
And everybody who's done this has the story about it. Cynthia just mentioned trading away a great first baseman who shall remain nameless. I have my season where when I ran a league and there was this guy, Kay Warner. He looks pretty good. My quarterbacks are injured.
Right.
And then he had a breakthrough season. This really sticks with people over the years, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, it's one of these phenomena that sort of just, has taken over.
What got you? You've been at this for a while, Matthew. What got you into fantasy sports in the first place?
What got me into it? You know what, I mean, sort of a sense of belonging. Like, one of the great things about fantasy sports is all the camaraderie and everything like that, right? The trash talk and the spending time with your friends, giving you a reason to spend time with somebody that you wouldn't normally get to otherwise. You know, at work we see it all the time. Like, the guy in the mailroom gets to talk trade with a CEO, and it brings people together. I was a 14-year-old kid in College Station, Texas, and I just moved there fairly recently, and yeah, I was taking some tennis lessons, actually, and my tennis coach, believe it or not, was forming a league. This is in 1984. I was 14 years old, and the game had just been invented. Like, the book describing the game had literally just come out. So for me, it was a chance to belong to something. you know, and that's what sort of drew me to the game.
And this is such a huge part of it, and a lot of what you write about in your book is the camaraderie. You mentioned the trash talking. How into it do the groups of people who form long-term leagues, how into it are they?
I mean, you know, they're crazy into it. You know, I don't know. Like,
give us some examples of crazy.
Like, here's an example of like how into it, you know, people get. I mean, the story is filled with books. The book is filled with stories of sort of obsession, if you will, of sort of like this kind of stuff. Like, you know, things like there's a league in Omaha, Nebraska, where the loser of the league has to get a tattoo. Like, not some henna tattoo, like a permanent rest of your life tattoo chosen by the winner of the league. Can you imagine getting a tattoo on your body that somebody else has chosen? And, of course, they're totally embarrassing. They've done it for 3 years in a row now. The loser last year had to get a tattoo of Justin Bieber's face. It says, fantasy loser. Hashtag YOLO swag. So, I mean, it's pretty intense. Like, I got a guy that was over in Afghanistan, and the only place where he could get internet was outside. So he's doing it outside, getting the Wi-Fi, doing his draft, and all of a sudden there is a bombing attack on the base. And instead of running for cover, he stayed out and kept drafting.
He doesn't want to abandon the draft.
Didn't want to abandon the draft. I think he sort of figured, like, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. But I need a running back. So, which, you know, I was amazed by that. But he proved it to me. And so, you know, people are really into it. The people that are into it are really into it. I compare it sort of to a Springsteen concert. I don't know if you've ever seen Bruce Springsteen in concert. But it's one of those things where it's like, you might be a fan of his music. You know he's popular, certainly. But until you see him in concert, and you see this guy play for 3.5 hours and just the way he connects with the audience, once you see him in concert, you're like, okay, now I get it. Now I understand why there's so many people that are so fanatical about him and, you know, travel all over. Fantasy sports is sort of the same way. Once you play it once, you understand why there's so many people obsessed with it.
In my head, I think of this as a guy thing, but Cynthia here has done it. In 1 year, my league was, I think, 50% female back when I was doing an annual league. Are a lot of women into fantasy sports?
Yeah, I mean, certainly not as many as men. About 25% of my Twitter following is female, which, you know, I was surprised when Twitter analytics showed me that. But it's primarily male, but certainly more and more women are getting into it. Football, by far the most popular sport, both with women and in general. I think like sports, right? You know, there are definitely female sports fans, but, you know, if you're looking for a majority, it's more men than women that are sports fans in general, and that sort of carries over to fantasy sports. But I've learned in doing fantasy that, and this is in the book, it's not just guys like me or you. It's 87-year-old grandmothers. It's husbands and wives. It's kids. It's doctors. It's, you know, priests, rabbis, and ministers. Sounds like the start of a joke, but it's actually 3 different fantasy leagues I know of. You know, Jay-Z plays in a league. Ashton Kutcher plays in a league. Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter himself, told my podcast audience once that Anquan Boldin was his fantasy Voldemort. So, I mean, people from all walks of life play, men, women, children, kids, grandmas, you name it.
Yeah, you've got a picture of a grandma celebrating after beating her grandkids, I think, in one league?
Yes, exactly. 87 years old and she won the title.
Now, if somebody out there is thinking, hey, this sounds like fun to me, I like the sports angle, I like the competition, the social angle, what's the key to finding or starting a good league?
I think it's finding good people. I mean, I think it's just like anything. Like, you know, yeah, there's definitely some people that could be jerks, you know. So I think it's finding a good group of people that have the right priorities, which is, this is something we're going to do for fun. This is something that we want to enjoy, and it's something to help us enjoy sports more, or if we're not actually into sports, give us a reason to root for sports. But in general, that's what I think. I think you just want a good group of people.
And maybe no tattoos at the beginning?
Yeah, exactly. I think ease off on the punishment. I mean, you know, listen, I think punishments for a league are, are actually great because it brings people together. Just make sure everyone's on board with it, because I wouldn't join a league where I had to get a tattoo for losing.
Exactly. I would not either. One complaint I hear from sports fans sometimes is the fantasy sports might divide your loyalties. You're a Packer fan, but the other side has Aaron Rodgers, or another Packer running back or receiver, say, Are you gonna be tempted to root against them? Do you think people feel that divided loyalty?
I think they can somewhat. I mean, I think it sort of depends on your fandom, right? I get that a lot. You know, one of the things that, you know, I would say to that sort of is like, look, I'm a Washington Redskins fan, and I have been since I was 5 years old. Nothing's going to overtake that. Like, I root for my fantasy teams, but not at the expense of my Redskins. And certainly, like, if I had Aaron Rodgers as my fantasy quarterback and he was playing the Redskins, I want the Redskins to win. But there's no reason that Aaron Rodgers can't throw 4 touchdown passes in a losing effort. you know, you can lose 43-42, you know. So I hear that argument a lot, and my sort of take on it is that I think it depends on your fandom. And I also think that, so what if you do? So what if you have divided loyalties? Who cares? The truth of the matter is that people watch and enjoy sports for lots of different reasons, right? You know, whether it's the social aspect, they like to go tailgate and they like to, you know, drink, or, you know, they just like, listen, I watch a bunch of Texas A&M football games because my father is a teacher there and he loves Texas A&M. So it's a way for me to bond with my father. So there's lots of different reasons to enjoy and watch sports. And sometimes you happen to be a fan of the Packers, or sometimes you're watching it because of your fantasy team. Like, who is somebody else to legislate how I enjoy sports? If you want to root for a group of players that Ted Thompson has gathered together, the general manager, and I want to enjoy a group of players that I've drafted as my own general manager, who's to say that, you know, I'm wrong?
We're talking to Matthew Berry about his new book, Fantasy Life, the outrageous, uplifting, and heartbreaking world of fantasy sports from the guy who's lived it.
And we want to hear from you. Do you play fantasy sports? Which ones do you play? And why do you spend your time playing fantasy sports? We want to hear your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@WPR.org.
We'll be taking your calls coming up after the break. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're continuing our discussion with Matthew Berry, and we'll be taking your calls as well. Do you play fantasy baseball, football, or something else? What do you love about fantasy sports, or perhaps do you hate it?
Or just call and tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call to gloat about last season or how the current baseball season's going for you. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Take some of your calls in just a couple minutes. But first, Matthew, how has the internet changed fantasy sports? When I first did it, I had pieces of paper and I had the newspaper section open and I was scribbling down all the stats from the previous weekend. What does it look like now?
Yeah, obviously you're hardcore, man. Well done. Same with me. Back in 84, like, there was no cell phones, no computers, no nothing. But now, obviously, the internet has made barrier to entry so much easier because it's easy to get in line. It's easy to keep track of all your stats. You don't have to do anything like that. It's all done for you on the computer. And in fact, you don't even need a computer. You can now draft and run your team from your tablet or your smartphone. Frankly, any device that is internet-enabled, at least on ESPN.com, can allow you to draft and manage your team. So what it's done is it's just made it much more easier. That the two things that I credit with the explosion of fantasy sports, the reason so many people play it these days, is the internet and the professional sports leagues and major media companies like ESPN getting behind it. Those are the two things.
And was that a slow process? I seem to remember the NFL maybe being a little wishy-washy if they wanted their stats used this way. What made them see the light?
Honestly, a study that came out in 2003 that noticed that the average football fan watched about 3 hours of football a week, but the average fantasy player watched 6 hours of football a week. So they realized that the people that were playing fantasy sports were their most hardcore users, were the people that were watching more football, buying more tickets, buying more jerseys, and they needed to cater to them, because having a fan that watches 6 hours is better than having a fan that watches 3 hours. So the more fans they could get to play fantasy sports, the better off for the health of the NFL and for all the other sports leagues, NBA, MLB, they've all followed suit. And same thing with ESPN. We know that our most hardcore fans and listeners, the people that interact with our content the most, are fantasy players.
We'll go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Mike with us in West Bend. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Hey, Matt. I've been playing in Fantasy Football League for about 6 years now, and I have emailed you with questions, but you don't really always get to answer me. But that's okay. I'm in a league where we have an automated draft, so the only thing I can do is prioritize the list of the players that I would like to draft. I mean, how can I go about strategizing that if I can at all?
Any advice, Matthew?
Yeah, well, first off, sorry I haven't gotten back to you. Just the volume of emails and tweets and stuff, that sometimes it just gets tough to get back to everyone. But I'll tell you, in this particular case, I think you have it right. It's just prioritizing your particular rankings based on your format, what you want. And, you know, there's not a lot, because obviously within a draft you're adjusting somewhat. But I think personally what I would do is I would load up on running backs up top. I would load up on running back sort of in the middle to late rounds, and try to get a quarterback somewhere in the mid rounds. Honestly, a lot of it's going to go into your ranking sheet, and there will be in season adjustments.
So that's something where they don't actually get together for a draft. It sounds like they just put in their preferences.
Right.
The computer, see, that to me would take all the fun out of it, because the best part of the whole season was getting together for the draft. You know, you cook out. We had people participating from London or Canada online, trash talking via primitive Yahoo chat.
Right.
Like that, the draft day is the best part, isn't it?
I agree with you. As my friend Don Smith, who got me into the league, into fantasy sports almost 30 years ago, says to me every single time we get together, it's only the best day of the year. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's, you know, draft day, it's all about draft day. I mean, you know, most people, you know, in the book I have stories about two chapters of people that have gone above and beyond to do things during the draft. Like, one of my favorites is, you know, I already told you about the guy in Afghanistan, but, you know, there was another one where a guy gets called into work 2 hours before the draft, and it's the only time the league can all get together. The season starts the next day. What are you going to do? And the guy says, hey, I need this job. Somebody called in sick. What do you want from me? I can't lose this job. So they say, okay, that's fine. You know, we're going to go to your work, and we will draft while you work. And where he was working was the Red Robin restaurant, where he was dressed as the Red Robin. So I have a picture of this in the book. Like, there's nine guys, and then this guy dressed as a giant red bird. You know, every 10 minutes or so, he'd waddle over and see who'd been picked. As he says, turns out a cheat sheet taped inside my beak was not ideal. But at the end of the day, he ended up getting it done. So, I mean, like, you know, draft day is that important that you're drafting it from a giant red bird costume, or, you know, going through a bombing or something like that. So I agree with you. That doesn't sound a lot of fun to me.
Talking to Matthew Berry about the rise and popularity of fantasy sports, fantasy football, fantasy baseball, you name it. If you're a fan, if you're into it, if you have a story to share, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've talked a lot about football. It's big on baseball. What other sports are out there that people are turning into a fantasy game?
Honestly, if you can keep score at it, there is a way to play a fantasy version of it. So in addition to the sports that I mentioned, you know, listen, there's fantasy golf. There's fantasy NASCAR. No pun intended, but in Japan, fantasy sumo wrestling is huge. Right? We offer fantasy bass fishing on ESPN.com. And it's not just sports, in fact. Pretty much any reality TV show that's a competition, Big Brother, American Idol, The Bachelor, they all have fantasy versions of it. My friends and I play on SummerMovieLeague.com, which is a fantasy movie website. And you pick real-life movies, and how well they do at the box office is how well they do for your fantasy studio. So if you can keep score at it, there's a way to play a fantasy version of it.
Now, when Mike called in, he reminded me a big part of the fantasy sports industry isn't just the watching of the game, the keeping score. It's people going to people like you for advice. How big is the fantasy football advice market?
You know, it's fairly big. I mean, I don't know that I have a quantifiable number, but there's no question about it. Like, the most common question is, who do I start on Sunday?
Right.
I mean, just give you an example, and this is certainly nothing about me, but just about the quest for knowledge and the quest for. But on a given month during the NFL season on Twitter, I get about 80,000 interactions a month. according to Twitter Analytics. And again, I'm not saying like, oh, I'm great or anything like that. I don't mean it. I think that's entirely driven by the fact that there's so many people that just they're desperate for advice. Hey, who do I start? You know, tell me who to play, this guy or that guy. Give me some information, you know. So, you know, our fantasy football rankings are always one of the most popular posts on ESPN.com. And, you know, there's a guy like me who gives fantasy advice at pretty much every website and a lot of bloggers and people on Twitter. So it's a very robust industry, no question.
It's a lot of pressure, man. Do you get a lot of angry feedback when your start injures himself stepping out onto the field?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, I think anyone that listen, I'm trying to predict the future. You know, that's my job is literally to predict the future. So it doesn't always go like you hope it would. And yes, believe it or not, not everyone on social media is polite and kind.
No, say it isn't so.
It's true. I swear. So you know, but it comes with the territory, and you know, I see it with a lot of. It happens to athletes. It happens to other people here at ESPN. It happens to you know other public figures that I follow that I'm fans of. So it comes with the territory. What are you going to do?
Anything new and interesting and exciting? Obviously, there was that whole internet thing that some of us saw out there. Anything new and exciting in the world of fantasy sports that that has you looking to check it out?
Well, I mean, technology continues to improve, and the fact that we're doing more and more on TV, the fact that, you know, listen, that I wrote a book that we have that literally on TV. For the longest time, fantasy was sort of held at arm's length, and now that there's a... You know, we do a Sunday morning TV show on called Fantasy Full Now on ESPN2. You know, there's a new wave of daily, what are called daily fantasy games. So they're very quick to play, and that's sort of an interesting thing that has sort of taken the industry a little bit by storm. That's sort of the new hot thing is you basically draft a team and you get the results in one day. You know, so it's based on one day's of stats versus typical fantasy, which is a season long.
How many leagues do you have going? Or are you in at any given time?
Oh, for football, usually around 10. I'm currently like in 5 baseball. I do a basketball one. I do the summer movie thing that I told you about. And then I do a handful of like eliminator or survivor type pools, you know, where you pick one win, you know, one team to win every week, you know, pick 'em leagues, you know, kind of office pool picks, that sort of thing. You know, I do a couple of March Madness pools as well. You know, tournament challenge. So,
and are you like are you like a hedge fund dealer where, all right, I've got this guy in this league. I'm going to hedge by getting a different player in this league. So if I do well here, I'm, you know, not so hurt in the other one.
Yeah, sometimes you do that. But generally speaking, when I'm going through my drafts, I just try to pick the best available player. And I tend to like the same play. You know, I like who I like, and so I tend to wind up with the same players on multiple teams because I'll like somebody more than sort of the consensus rankings are that are out there, or I won't be as high on somebody as others. So, you know, there'll be players that I know that there's no way I'm owning that guy this year because I'm just too low on him, and someone will draft him before it gets to me.
Matthew, thanks a lot for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Matthew Berry. He's ESPN senior fantasy analyst, author of the new book Fantasy Life, The Outrageous, Uplifting, and Heartbreaking World of Fantasy Sports from the Guy Who's Lived It.
Coming up, we'll check the latest news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at how the community of Oak Creek is observing the one-year anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.